But what does this mean? Let's look at the definition of modern agriculture. It's the use of land to convert petroleum into food. And we can see the end of the petroleum.
We've all been told hydraulic fracturing, fracking, will make the United States into the new Saudi Arabia. The UK, Poland, China, and probably everywhere else will get new energy riches too. Already, American oil and gas production have increased for the first time in decades. Has fracking proved the peak oil theorists wrong? Here to help us is one of the best-known writers on energy depletion. In 2003, Richard Heinberg published one of the first big books on the subject, The Party's Over, Oil, War, and the Fate of Industrial Societies. He's been publishing the popular newsletter since 1992. Now Richard Heinberg returns to Radio EcoShock with his answers to fracking. The new book is called Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. Richard, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Well, it's a pleasure to be speaking with you, Alex.
You say in your introduction to your new book that you need to speak to, quote, my people, the ones who have been warning about an energy shortage for years. Is the peak oil theory blown away by new technology in fracking?
Well, short answer, no, absolutely not. Basically, what we're seeing is peak oil in action. World production of regular conventional crude oil minus tar sands and tight oil has been declining since about 2005-2006. Now, the shortfall has been more than made up for by tar sands and tight oil, and so world oil production has been increasing slightly in recent years, but at a cost, both financial cost. The oil industry is struggling. It's investing about twice as much in exploration and production as a decade ago, drilling twice as many wells to produce only marginally more product, and also an environmental cost because all of the new production is coming from expensive and environmentally risky sources like the ones I've mentioned, tar sands, tight oil, also deep water oil. So as time goes on, more and more of the oil that's produced a higher and higher percentage will be from these marginal sources. And that's going to be both a financial problem for the industry to be able to maintain production, and the signs are that they won't be able to much longer, and also an increasing environmental risk for the rest of the world. So basically, this is exactly what the peak oil theorists have been talking about for the last decade or more. And rather than talk about the death of peak oil, I think we should be talking about this is what peak oil looks like.
We should quickly define one term. What is tight oil?
Right. Tight oil is oil that's in reservoirs of rock that have very low porosity, or excuse me, permeability. So the oil or gas, the same principle applies to natural gas. The oil or gas is there, but it just doesn't want to move. So if you sink a conventional vertical oil or gas well into these kinds of rocks, you may get an initial little puff of production, but it won't last very long, and the amount of fuel produced won't be enough to pay for the cost of sinking the well. Geologists have known about these tight reservoirs for a long time, and we're talking here about the Bakken in North Dakota, which is a mostly oil-producing tight reservoir. And tight gas reservoirs like the Eagle Ford and Barnett in Texas, the Marcellus in Pennsylvania, these have been known about for a long time. Often they're called shale, like shale gas or shale oil. It's not always shale rock, but as a useful shorthand, that's just fine.
You talk about for a long time, and that sort of piqued my interest in something you wrote about in the book, that fracking has been around for a long time. It's not a brand new technology.
Yeah, that's correct. Hydrofracturing per se has been around for several decades, and it's widely used by the oil and gas industry, not just for producing from tight reservoirs, but also in conventional oil production, especially in secondary and tertiary recovery stages after wells start to decline. But what's different here is that when we talk about fracking today, we're mostly talking about the application of hydrofracturing in combination with sophisticated cocktails of chemicals. Up to 700 different chemicals are used, slickening agents, propants, and so on. And also, together with horizontal drilling. Now, it's been necessary to combine these technologies in order to produce from these low permeability plays that we've been talking about, the tight oil and shale gas plays. And that's where the higher costs come from, and that's where the greater risks come from, because we're talking about wells that may cost up to $10 million a piece to drill, much more than a conventional oil or gas well, and wells that also entail much higher risks to air, water, and human health.
You do write about the environmental impacts of fracking, and we will get to that, but a lot of this book is about the economic illusion behind the fracking bandwagon. Beyond the energy companies, large and small, who are the players who are making big money from the fracking boom?
Well, you know, I would argue that the investment banks, Wall Street, has made as much money from the fracking boom as anybody else. All of the companies that are engaged in fracking, and mostly we're here talking about smaller companies, not the major oil companies like Shell and Chevron, BP, Exxon, but smaller companies like Chesapeake, Devon, Range, Anadarko, and so on. All of these companies are leveraged to the hilt. It costs them a lot to do business, and in many cases, they're not really making money from the sale of product. The way they're making money is through almost a kind of pyramid scheme where they're hyping the potential of shale production in the future as a way of increasing the value of their assets. And their assets, in many cases, consist of drilling leases. When this whole shale rush started just a few years ago, these small companies were competing with each other to lease as much land as possible. And very quickly, they leased millions of acres of land for drilling. Some folks in the audience may have seen the movie Promised Land by Matt Damon. It's kind of a fictional representation of what's been going on in the past few years in shale country. Well, it's by hyping future potential that the value of these leases is kept high, and companies are then able to borrow more on the basis of the value of their assets. They're also able to sell these shale drilling leases to other companies, including big companies like Shell and BP, and also foreign companies in China and other places. And that's how they've actually been subsisting. It's not so much on sale of product as on sales of assets, mergers, acquisitions, and so on. And Wall Street takes a big share in all of those kinds of financial transactions. So the companies are they're operating a kind of Ponzi scheme, if you will. And Wall Street is very happy to go along for the ride, and they make off like bandits one way or the other.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the name of the report. I think it came out of the UK. I covered it not too long ago about the possibility that the whole world economic system could crash because the big oil companies themselves were like a Ponzi scheme. They keep talking about their reserves and their possible future money in order to raise new stock money now. Can you remember what that was?
Well, there have been several articles because there's an effort now to talk institutional investors into divesting from oil companies because of the climate risk in producing all of these fossil fuels. And the argument is, if we produced anything like the reserves that the oil and gas and coal industry claim, then, you know, we'd have climate Armageddon. So one way or another, all of those reserves of coal, oil, and natural gas are not going to be produced, which means that the value of the assets of these companies is not as great as they're claiming. And once again, even the big oil companies use the value of their assets as a basis on which to raise more money through stock shares or borrowing otherwise.
Do you think fracking is going to be a long-lived phenomenon or short-lived?
Well, you know, as long as the oil industry lasts, I'm sure fracking will be going on. What's not so sure is that we'll see anything like the current rate of production. Now, it's true, over the past few years, the U.S. has produced a lot of natural gas and oil through fracking. U.S. natural gas production is at its highest point ever. And more than all of the increase in the last few years has come from fracking, because conventional natural gas production in the U.S. is actually falling. So similarly with U.S. oil production. U.S. oil production had been in a decline since about 1970, and just in the last few years, U.S. oil production has actually picked up as a result of hydrofracking in North Dakota and Texas primarily. Now, the claim of the industry is that this is just the beginning, that we have 100 years of natural gas and the U.S. is about to become the next Saudi Arabia. The data do not back up those claims. We looked at the numbers at Post Carbon Institute. We purchased the rights to data on over 60,000 currently producing horizontally drilled and hydrofractured wells, both oil and gas, in the U.S. And we looked at initial production rates, the rate of decline in production over time for each well, geographic location. What we found is that in each of the major plays where fracking is going on, there's a core area, usually just a few counties in extent, where production is pretty prolific and profitable. But if you get outside of those core areas, those sweet spots, initial production rates are much lower. Production rates decline very rapidly over time. So taking those decline rates into account, taking into account the high geographic variability and the quality of these plays, it appears to us that the claims that are being made for future production of tight oil and shale gas are wildly overblown. This is mostly hype. And before 2020, before the end of this decade, we'll be seeing declining U.S. oil and gas production, and perhaps rapid declines in both fuels.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with the longtime voice of peak oil and energy sanity, Richard Heinberg. We're talking about his new book on fracking, Snake Oil. Well, who is behind these never-ending press stories that America can have 200 years' worth of energy from fracking or be the new Saudi Arabia? It's fantastic stuff.
It is, and it's mostly these small companies that have led the charge. Chesapeake Energy, for example, for up until the last few months, its CEO was a guy named Aubrey McClendon, and he was famous for talking up the potential of shale gas. He testified before Congress. He wrote op-eds for the Wall Street Journal. You know, his voice was very prominent in all of this. And, you know, when he made these claims, they weren't really attached to any scientific studies. It was mostly just, you know, trust us, we're in the business. And so you find President Obama parroting basically the same line, saying that the U.S. has 100 years of natural gas, when there's no real data to back that up. This is really why I wrote the book. The title, Snake Oil, is not about the oil and gas per se that we're talking about. It's about the hype. It's about the inflated claims that have been made for shale gas and tight oil, and how those claims are undermining sound energy policy at all levels of government.
And you've talked about the work that Post Carbon Institute did before you wrote this. Tell us about the David Hughes report, Drill Baby Drill.
Sure. Yes, my book is largely based on this report. And David Hughes is a retired petroleum geologist who worked for the Canadian Geological Survey. And in that job, he prepared major reports for the Canadian government, crunching lots of numbers having to do with production of natural gas, coal, and other fossil fuels. So he's very well acquainted with the terrain. He has the analytic skills to be able to do a report like this. We really wanted to find out what was at the bottom of the shale boom. And as I mentioned earlier, we bought the rights to data on all of these wells. We bought them from a company in Austin, Texas, Drilling Info. And we produced what I think is, as far as I've been able to tell, the most comprehensive report or study that's been done to date on shale gas and tight oil, including by the International Energy Agency and the U.S. Department of Energy. And that 180-page report is available as a free PDF download. You can go to shalebubble.org, that's shalebubble.org, and download and read it for yourself. My book, Snake Oil, is basically an effort to put that information into layman's terms and then draw conclusions and also look at a few other aspects of fracking, like the environmental impacts and the Wall Street connection.
Could you, Richard Heinberg, please describe for us what Hughes calls the treadmill to hell, that constant need to drill more and more and more wells?
Right. Well, this comes from the high decline rates. All oil and gas wells decline in production over time. So if you drill a well in January, chances are by December of the same year, production of oil or gas will already have started to decline a little bit. Well, in the case of shale wells, particularly once you get outside of the sweet spots, the core areas, the decline rates are savage. We're talking about 60, 70, 80% decline in production in the very first year. So in order to even keep overall production steady on a straight line, it's necessary to drill and drill and drill. This is why we're talking about so many wells already having been drilled and lining up ready to be drilled. It's not as though the shale oil and gas industry can just drill a few wells and produce all of this product that they're talking about. They've already drilled tens of thousands of wells, and by the time all of this is over, they will have drilled many tens of thousands more with all of the attendant environmental risks and investment costs. Each of these wells, as I think I mentioned earlier, may cost $10 million to drill. We'll multiply that by 100,000. That's $1 trillion. And that gives you some sense of how much is being invested in this shale phenomenon.
Yeah, and you're right that each well has to burn about 2,000 gallons of diesel oil a day just to keep the rig running. What are some of the main environmental impacts? We won't be able to go into all of them, but maybe you could touch on what fracking does.
A lot of it has to do with water, both sourcing water, because it takes 3 or 4 million gallons to frack each well. So in places that have water shortages like Colorado and Wyoming, Texas and Oklahoma and so on, that's a problem, just getting the water, because the frackers are in competition with agriculture and city water use and so on. But also, there's the problem of what to do with the water once you've fracked. You have to take the water up out of the well in order to start producing oil or gas. Well, what do you do with it then? It has all these chemicals in it. It also has pollutants that have been picked up deep underground, very often radioactive elements. So do you put it in a holding pond and let it evaporate? Well, the holding ponds leak. Well, do you send it to a water treatment plant? Well, water treatment plants aren't prepared to deal with these kinds of pollutants. You can inject it back down deep underground into old oil or gas wells, and the industry likes to do that. But in that case, what you're doing is taking perfectly good fresh water, which is more and more at a premium these days, polluting it, and then taking it out of the hydrological cycle where it can never be used again. So there's no good answer to that problem. There are other environmental problems as well having to do with air quality and human health, health of pets and livestock and wildlife that have all been traced, documented to fracking.
And we do have to now consider deep ground ecology. There is life down there, maybe bacterial life, plus important networks of water. Will those million-old wells, if we get that many, will they leak? Will they create unwanted pathways for underground change?
There is a study that was published in a peer-reviewed industry journal suggesting, just a couple of years ago, suggesting that evidence is coming down on the side that says that eventually just about all oil and gas wells will leak. I mean, during the period in which the oil or gas well is actually being used, it's producing, if it's properly drilled, properly cased and cemented, chances are there won't be any contact between the well bore and the water table. But that's a pretty brief stretch of time. We're talking about maybe 10 years, something like that, maybe 20 years. What happens after that? Well, of course, the well is plugged and abandoned. But the well casing may fail decades, centuries afterward, and at that point, there's every possibility for water table to be contaminated by the oil or gas or by other chemicals.
You know, I was just thinking about this. Richard Heinberg, a lot of your life, your research, your books are about the underground world from oil to coal. I wonder, why did you spend so much time looking downward?
Right. Well, I never really thought about it that way, you know. my interest in fossil fuels has nothing to do with some inherent fascination with geology. I didn't even study geology in school. My interest is in energy and social, environmental, historic, political implications of energy. And fossil fuels have been the biggest energy story of the millennium. I mean, there's been nothing before them that were anything like fossil fuels, and we probably will never have anything like them again. They're changing the climate. They've completely altered the economy of the world. And most people just take them for granted. So, to me, this is not something to be taken for granted. We're living in an extraordinary moment in human history. And if we don't understand the role of fossil fuels in this moment, then we're just not getting it.
We can't leave fracking without talking about the myth that could drive us all into an overheated extinction, and that is that fracked natural gas is a bridge fuel and a cleaner alternative to coal. Is that true?
I don't believe so. There's a lot of controversy on this. There have been studies that say that methane being a more powerful greenhouse gas than CO2, that methane leaking from fracked natural gas wells is coming out in such quantities that it does away with any possible climate advantage to switching over to generating electricity from natural gas as opposed to coal. Then there are other studies coming out, mostly funded by the natural gas industry, that say, no, the leakage is very small and there is a tremendous climate advantage to burning natural gas. The scientists are going to be trying to sort this out for some time. It appears to me that the industry-funded studies are being very carefully constructed to look only at natural gas wells that are properly drilled and cased and cemented, where nothing is going wrong. And some of the other measurements that show very high leakage are probably taking into account wells where everything wasn't done exactly according to standard. And so we may find at the end of the day that, in fact, the folks who are raising the alarm about natural gas leakage are in fact onto something. But in any case, the promise of natural gas as a bridge fuel rests entirely on the assumption that we have enough of the stuff to be able to burn it instead of coal for decades to come while we gradually, slowly build a renewable energy economy, maybe by mid-century or so. Well, we don't, in fact, have that much natural gas. If our study at Post Carbon Institute is correct, before the end of this decade, we'll be seeing declining production of natural gas. That's not a bridge fuel. It's a bridge to nowhere. It's a gangplank.
And as we might expect from a senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute, you do write about an alternative energy reality. You call it hydrocarbon rehab. Do you want to give us a sneak peek, a quick snapshot? What are you talking about there?
In our future, we will have less in the way of fossil fuels, no matter what we do. We will have a renewable energy future by the end of this century, one way or another, whether we've planned for it and worked for it, or whether it's just a matter of using all the fossil fuels we can afford to get out of the ground and then letting the economy collapse in a dead heap. A better way to go would, of course, obviously be to build that renewable energy economy proactively, starting now, starting 10 years ago, starting 20 years ago, if we could. Obviously, we can't, but we can at least start now. And it's really the only way we can ensure a sound economic future. Otherwise, we're handcuffing ourselves to an energy economy that has no future.
Can you please just give us a couple of websites where people can follow your work?
Absolutely. A good one is resilience.org. That's our institutional website for Post Carbon Institute. And also, if folks are interested in the book Snake Oil, they can find out more about that also on my website, which is richardheinberg.com.
Richard's the longtime author of the online journal The Muse Letter. He's been the voice of the peak oil movement with books like The Party's Over and Peak Everything. We've been talking about his latest of 10 books, Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. It's a good read, packed with facts we all ought to know. Richard, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
It's a pleasure, Alex. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.